Thank you, Damon. Name's Pat Hilton. Grateful and happy to be an alcoholic. Hey, gang. I don't know what you call this group, but if I were to name it, I think I'd call it the hair of the dog group or something. I've never gotten up at this hour in my lifetime except to come home. I don't think I ever got up at this hour. But it certainly was worth it with the quality of those cinnamon rolls and the food that I've had today. I thank you for that. I appreciate you inviting me, Damon, to come and share at your anniversary breakfast meeting. I spoke here a couple of years ago at one of the other anniversaries. I don't remember what it was, but I remember the food was good and the people were great. And that I find pretty much true in AA wherever I go. I did wander around the room, and I didn't see any red eyeballs in the whole damn place, and that's an easy to bizarre for what we call alcoholics. You know, it looked like a pretty healthy group going on here. Maybe I should have started getting up earlier in my life somewhere along the way. I don't know exactly where I'll take off because I've never tried to make any kind of a talk at 8 o'clock other than utter, where's my tea, and what's for breakfast. But anyway, I always like to know, he asks, is there any person here for their first meeting? I like to know, is there anyone here for their last meeting? No? Good. Can you hear me in the back? I used to ask that question, and people in the back would say no, and then the people in the front would get up and move to the back. So I usually don't ask that question much anymore. But for the grace of God, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and people like you all over this planet, it hadn't been necessary for me to take a drink since August the 22nd of 1975. And I'm one of the lucky fellows along the way. You know, I've lived now over 31 years on nothing but food and water. And for us, that's a little unusual. But I like the life that goes along with that program. I started off my AA out in Los Angeles area. I grew up with the Alabams and the Chuck C's and the Clancy's and those kinds of names, Norm Alpie. Wonderful people. We say principles before personalities, but I'm here to say that most of those personalities had phenomenal principles, and I was fortunate to be hanging around most of those in that time zone, in the 70s time zone. And I had another pal by the name of Herb, and Herb had 35 years in AA when I came. I came in 75, so he was here in 1940. And Herb was a world-class scientist. And he, I stayed with him for 5 years, not living with him, but I took him to 3 meetings a week, and we met socially another couple of times a week. But I hang around quality people like Herb. I think that's why I've had such success in AA, is I hung around the people who really were succeeding, who were not just succeeding, who were happy to be sober. I don't ever hang around, I'm sober and it sucks, you know. Those people, God bless them, you know, but you're not going to hang around me long. I stick around anybody for a while if you want to try to rise up, but if you want to suck me down there where you are, forget it, I ain't coming down. I let anyone add to my life today, but I don't let anyone subtract from my life. And Herb taught me these kinds of things, and he said, Pat, reserve the right to change your mind. He said, along your path, your journey, you will learn, if you'll keep your mind open, that you will have new points of view on things that you think are so true today will not be nearly so true as you go along. And I have found that to be true. And but Herb was, as I said, a world-class scientist. He won a couple of Academy Awards. He danced with famous movie stars. He was a concert pianist. But as Clancy used to say of him, when he's drunk, Herb can't find his ass with both hands. And that's kind of what alcohol does to us. You can hit brilliant people, and suddenly we can't even find our own rear end. But Herb told me, he said, Pat, he said, don't listen to those people who talk to you about cautioning about the pink cloud. He said, I have been on one for 35 years. And he said, you don't have to be miserable if you don't want to be miserable. You don't ever have to play that. He said, so I try to adopt that for my life today. People call me Happy Pat because I choose to be happy. I like being happy. Doesn't mean I don't. I've had some events in this past year that have caused me some difficulties. My mom died. She's lived with us for the last 25 years in my house. I miss her every day of my life today. She was the sweetest, kindest, gentlest person I know. And there's no two ways about it. I don't miss my mom, but I don't go get drunk over that. And one of the benefits of this drinking was my mom got to say to me, you're the son I always thought you would be. You know, she was proud of her son that had turned his life around, who was going to kill himself by age 30, who now has made it to 67, still going. But let me tell you, no matter how old you get, parents never stop looking for signs of improvement. She was always hoping I would do better. And I think that's a good way to always, I look at my children the same, and I have been blessed to have I had no children before I came here, but since having come to AA, I have two children, one 35, he was in the marriage when I married my wife, and my daughter, she's 28. And I have a few grandchildren, and these were things that I swore would never be in my life when I drank. I was married a couple of times in that drinking time, short-term relationships, and they would terminate. But each of those wives had no interest in having children, and I kind of bought into that, too. I don't think I want any either. You know, and that really wasn't true. I just kind of bought in to go along with the situation. And today I can say that one of the greatest blessings of my sobriety is to have those children in my life and to know what children mean to you and to see them grow up healthy and happy and not to have to, having seen their father addicted in any of the departments, you know, their lives have turned out beautifully and they stay close to Dad. I like that they only live a mile or two away from me, so I'm a lucky fellow. Well, I didn't come and brag about my family. I tried to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, what it's like today. And if I somehow leave you today with the impression that I don't think AA is the most great, wonderful thing on this planet for people like us, then I've left you with the wrong impression, because that's exactly the way I feel about it. It gave me a life beyond my wildest dreams. I have had an incredible life. And that's not because Pat's a great guy. It's because this program works. And when I spend my time spending more time helping you than I do working on me, somehow I get tremendous benefits from doing so. But I hung around those people that I said to you a while ago who enjoy their sobriety, who are active in service, who make things happen for AA. They aren't just people who come to meetings. They come to meetings, get the idea, and go out and put it into practice, into place, and in their communities and in their lives. That's what we're talking about here. It's easy to be a good guy sitting around here. I can sit here and BS you all day long, and my mouth can flap up and down, and I can sound really great and quote the big book, but if I close that door there and become a whole different human being, you know, that's not what we're talking about. It isn't what you know, it's what you do. I don't get measured by the speeches I make. I get measured by the actions of my life. And today I can say I'm doing a better job of that than I've ever done in my lifetime. Anyway, I started off as a fairly normal family. I wasn't coming from, wasn't mistreated or have broken families. My parents stayed together until my father died in 1979. And I was just a little kid. I didn't like my name. My name was Pat. I thought it was a girl's name. I was scrawny and skinny and afraid of everything. And my dad was big and noisy like me. He had this big old voice that scared me to death. And I think I just lived in a lot of fear from the beginning. And resentments towards myself and where I fit in. I didn't feel comfortable in my situations. And we had my father's brother lived with us, and he was Uncle Pat. And Uncle Pat was a great big guy, so he got to be known as Big Pat, and I got to be known as Little Pat. And I try to tell people today, when you're little, you know it. We don't need somebody, hi, Little Pat, Little Pat, oh, Little Pat. Good to see you, Little Pat. I mean, I heard that over and over and over, you know, and little has a lot of not so good connotations. It can be okay, but there are some that some of us take it a little personally. And anyway, I just think there's just little things like that along the way that probably subtracted from my feelings towards myself. I had this noisy voice like I do today, and on my third grade report card, the teacher wrote home, "When Patrick whispers, it's like a grown man shouting." Well, our book, if you turn in here, it says, "Noisy good fellow craving attention," you know? And that's what I was when I started, and I haven't changed a whole lot in that department. I'm still a noisy little fellow. Anyway, nothing unusual really took place. I got eventually into the university. I started my first drinking definitely when I was 14. I visited an uncle in Ohio, and we found this Mogan David grape juice, we thought, and took that little bit of stuff, and it was wonderful. And I can remember the very next year making the trip back, and one of the first places we went to that refrigerator to recapture that feeling of that, and we put more water into it to make it look like we hadn't drank quite so much as a little kid. And we were about, I said 14, it was probably more like 12. I was 12 because I had gone to California by 14. Anyway, but strange, alcoholics can typically remember their very first drink. others haven't done. I mean, it's kind of a, not, didn't make such a big statement in their head, but to us it makes a big statement. And I went on to high school and I did silly things there. I was a smart little kid. I raised my hand real fast. You always hate the kid that got his hand up with the damn answer. Everybody doesn't like you. So I would quit doing that and just make jokes. I'd move from California, I mean from West Virginia to California. And I didn't sound like everybody out there, you know, and they make fun of the way you talk. And everything about me I just was not liking. So I became kind of the class clown, do funny things, climb in through the window rather than come in the door. Silly things. Got to the university of Southern California, and we're playing tonight on 4:30, beating UCLA, I hope. Anyway, play national championship again, I hope. I went to that particular school, and I lived with a fellow there by the name of Larry. And Larry, I always said, if only my life were like Larry. Larry was a very wealthy man. Each of the grandchildren in his grandfather's family got $1 million when they were 21 years of age. And they were famous oil people. And you hear Doheny Drive in Beverly Hills. That's the same Larry Doheny that I live with. And Larry had this big Mercedes Roadster in the 60s now. And diamond bracelets around. We had TV in every room. The first week we were there, he had a second refrigerator installed with a tapper installed. The Budweiser man came every Saturday delivering the kegs to our apartment. One of my advisors once said to me, Pat, you need a school with a maximum amount of with a maximum amount of social entertainment, a minimum amount of education, just for the hell of it. Well, that's what I was getting. The tappers, we had a very popular place. But back to Larry again. Larry went around with Pete Peterson, the founder of Hot Rod Magazine. Those two were close pals, and they had their own private booth in one of the fanciest restaurants over in Beverly Hills. And I used to go with them. You know, I was just the tag along. I wasn't one of them. I was just the tag along, and felt really good. Well, I would say if only my life were like Larry, I'd have it made. Well, Larry died at 28, and Pat's still here yakking, you know, some 40 years later, I'm still here. And Larry, I found out, didn't care much about being Larry any more than Pat cared about being Pat. He just had more money than I had, and that was it. He could accelerate his demise. He had other ways to speed up. And it was drugs and alcohol that got Larry. And he had spent his $1 million by the time he was 28 years of age. Not significant, because he'd get another if he wished. Anyway, but nothing was going on. I was in a fraternity there, and we did lots of drinking parties, of course, and I just did silly things, you know, like take off your clothes at the wrong time at a party or something, walk around with a lampshade on my head, or, you know, silly little things. No major occurrences really taking place. I think drinking at this time had fun associated with it. There were fun with minor difficulties, but there was still a lot of laughs and fun and silly times. That I guess I just thought that's the way college would be. So anyway, moving right along, I get out of that university and I go to work. And at work, I get a purchasing job, and I'm taken to lunch all the time. So I'm drinking. I finally have a restaurant with my name on the table reserved every day for me, because I come there, and I'm going to have my martinis every day. I'd order a bottle of Lancers, and I'd use that for my martinis, because I'd drink the gin, and I'd put a teaspoon of Lancers into my martinis. And when I finished the bottle of Lancers, I had enough martinis, I would conclude. Well, I would get fried day after day, and my boss called me in, and he was going to send me off to some kind of problem. He said he thought I had some kind of problem with alcohol. And I guess they were, you know, this is a long time ago, and they were a little careful about how they handled those situations then, more so than they just didn't have much of experience. We didn't have people on site to help you with your programs that the people, benefits and things such as that. Anyway, didn't get sent away, but I said, you know, it's my parents are dying, they have cancer, and if I could just maybe move and get a new location, they sent me to Lucky, Georgia. I came down here for a little while. Well, on the way, I drove my car here, and I stopped at every border town along the way, and I came into town with like 42 fifths of booze. This Oso Negro gin and Kahlua, especially, was so cheap when you stopped in Mexico and brought all this in. When I went home, I had even more. I'd sent all my clothes, my guitar and everything by bus, and so I could fill up my car with more and more and more booze on the way back home. And those were my priorities were. It was with the drinking stuff. I didn't have friends who didn't drink, didn't trust people who didn't drink. Anyway, life progressed, and I got married, and I guess I kind of would forget that I was married. I was the type of guy, when it's time to go home, I'm going to go home with my wife or your wife. It didn't really matter. I'm just going to go home with a wife. And it was kind of my general attitude, and that's not well accepted by the one you're married to, especially if she isn't the one. And I did those things, and I came home once upon a time. You know, also after a while, I'd go over, like on Friday at lunch, and one time I didn't come back for 3 or 4 days. And when I got there, there was a note on my car, and it said, "Patrick, you have hurt me very deeply this time, and I'll never forgive you." That's what that note said. I like to remind myself of those kinds of things. Because, you know, all the time I would say, "I'm only hurting me, leave me alone, da-da-da-da-da-da." And in fact, I hurt a lot of people along the way. And wives were one of those that I did. I have major automobile accidents, and that's one of the other events that just happened here 2 weeks ago. I'm lucky to even be standing here talking to you tonight. I had a Corvette, and I was hit basically head-on at about 50 miles an hour. The car is demolished, and who would come along within a minute after the wreck? My friend Mike here. AA always shows up to help get me out of this car and get my stuff out. And, you know, I ended up with a couple of bruises and a little tweak here or there, but for an old guy, I did really good. Nothing broken, and I'm still together. But that took place. But the crashes back then, see, this one I can remember. Those I had no clue what happened. One of them, I was leaving the bar, and I was going to go kill my sister's boyfriend. That was my plan. I didn't like this guy, and I found out she was going with him. I said, "I'm going to go kill the bastard tonight, and I'm going that way." And I got my little Porsche, and away I go. This is in California. And I crash, and I burn, and I get taken away to the hospital, and they sew up my head 50 stitches front to back. And so anyway, the hard part of that is to fill out your insurance report, because I had no clue what happened. You know, I said this guy suddenly stopped in front of me in this big yellow car, and of course the police were following me. They saw me. I hit a little parked car. I just swerved off the side of the road. So the reports never look the same, what you tell your agent, what the police have. And fortunately, there was a guy there at the hospital who... he was a plastic surgeon. The next day I went to see him. He said, "I bet you've never had a hangover quite like this one, have you?" I said, "No, sir, I haven't. It really hurt." Anyway, the car was crashed, but they couldn't give me a drinking ticket that time, because if you have head injuries, they're not allowed to give you blood tests in California. But I had a number of others. I had been out drinking with them. First I go out looking for a new wife. And where would I go? The Blanky Stone, Barney Stone, the Yankee Peddler, the King Czars, my usual haunts. You know, I'm looking for her, and we found each other, and we deserved each other. She was my glassy lassie. She was from Glasgow, Scotland. I always called her my little glassy lassie. And they would talk like this, "A wee little kid better canny so willny." Whenever her family laughed, I laughed. I had no idea what they... that means. "I would if I could, but I can't, so I won't." They'd say, "I would if I could, but I can't, so will me." Oh. I was just in Scotland here a couple of months ago. I go over there every other year for a golf deal with some friends, and there was a little... I went to an AA meeting. There was a Scotsman sitting next to me, and I brought some tapes that Damon gave him to give to this group. And he said, "Hey, Pot, have you got those?" And I couldn't understand what then followed. I said, "Johnny, forgive me. I heard your mouth. I heard the noise, but I don't understand what you just said to me." "Pot, I want to know, do you have the speaker by the name of..." And he said this name again. I said, "Johnny, I still didn't get it." And all the group's laughing, you know. And he said, "I'll be damned." He said, "You know," he said, 10 years ago when I come to AA, nobody could understand me. I've been here 10 years, and you still cannot understand me." Oh, he was hilarious. Anyway, these are kind of the fun things I have in my life today, those kinds of events. So anyway, back to this other wife that we met. Her father was the featherweight champion of the British Empire. And I say that not to impress you, because it wouldn't anyway, but just let you know, when we got in a fight, who won? She could beat the hell out of me, didn't she? Yeah, tough little girl. And, you know, we it was quite a deal. It really helped me later on when I was doing business in Scotland with an airplane company over there years later. When I introduced myself to this old Scotsman there, He said, I told him, I said, you know, once upon a time I was married to a girl from here in Glasgow, and I told her who the Johnny McGrory's done. Johnny McGrory! He got all excited. His eyes got big as good. Yeah, pot! I used to carry the rounds in between the round numbers in between the rounds of fight. And from that day on, I got all their business the rest of the time. He was so in love with Johnny McGrory that he helped me get that business forever. It's funny how little things in your life that you think aren't much of anything, somewhere, if you stick around a while and pay attention, you'll find that these things fit in. We never have a clue what's good for us. Never. It's a quick story of the Middle East. You know, the fellow who has this big, beautiful black stallion. And the people say, oh, what good luck you have. Look at that big, magnificent horse. He says, good luck, bad luck, who knows? The horse runs away. He says, oh, what bad luck you have. He said, well, good luck, bad luck, who knows? Well, the horse comes back with five mares. And he says, oh, look what good luck you have. He said, good luck, bad luck, who knows? The next day, his kid's out playing. The horse is trapping, break the kid's leg. Says, oh, what bad luck you have. He says, good luck, bad luck, who knows? The next day, the army comes recruiting soldiers. Oh, they can't take the kid. He has a broken leg. Well, anyway, the story goes on and on and on like that, which is the point, is that we never know which of these events are good for us. When I got sober, I went back to that Scottish wife. We had been estranged. I'd been thrown out, is another way to put it. Anyway, and I went back to see if I could. It was her birthday. I took her a present, and I was telling her about my new way of life. She said she didn't give a damn about my present or my new way of life. You know, and I went out that night, and I said, I'll be damned. You don't even get your wife back in this deal, you know. That's exactly the thought I had. Exactly. And I remembered a speaker that I had heard just perhaps a month before, and I hated this woman. She was like me. She had a lot of years of sobriety and lots of people following her around, and I was so envious of her, I hated her. You know, that's exactly the way it was. But Barbara had made this talk that night. She said, there isn't a thing that could happen to you that a drink would make better. And she was telling about her sponsor having to have her leg amputated, and that's what the sponsor had said to her. She was telling of her husband dying of cancer, very, very soon to die of cancer at that time. And she ended that talk by saying, there isn't a thing that could happen to you. And that's the only thing I remembered when I made that. I didn't remember all the other hundreds and thousands of things I'd heard. I remembered that one sentence. And then I had to go see Barbara and have lunch with her and tell her what I had been thinking and how I was so jealous of her and how I was resentful of her, and when in fact I wanted to thank you for saving my life that night. Your one sentence is the one thing I remembered, and I'm still sober because you said what you said. I come from the groups that we call it give 'em strokes, not pokes. I'm never going to kick you in the ass in AA. I might jolt you a little bit, but I'm never going to kick you. Because I'm of the opinion that we've been kicked in the ass enough by the time we get here. I don't need one more person to tell me I'm an idiot and that I'm worthless and I am not doing good. I know all that. I need one person who'll come up and give me a big old hug and say, you little bastard, you can do it too. You know? You ain't terrific, but by God, you can get there. You know? And they help me get there. That's the kind of people I need in my life. But the point I started to make on that, I am so glad she didn't come back. That would have been a major mistake. You know, that wife I just talked about that I plead to come back, wife since remarried, been married now 30 years, 30 some odd years, 30 years actually, exactly, in November this month it was, and have the children and everything that went with it. So it... You know, God knew what I needed. I didn't know what I needed. I knew that all that other stuff needed to go away, and which I think is so horrible at the time, to be replaced by something which is truly magnificent in my life today. So, this second wife and I were out drinking in a... I'm going to get sober here pretty soon. Oh, sorry, just came in my mind. Maybe I do need to wake up earlier. You know, when I was out entertaining a client one night with the Scottish wife and I, and we were in a restaurant, and all of a sudden we got mad at each other, she and I, and this huge noises were taking place. And I storm out of the restaurant, and we're yelling and screaming. This is how I entertain clients. So we're out there yelling and screaming and carrying on, and I get in the phone booth, I'm calling the cab to come take me home. Before I know it, there's five black and white cars around my phone booth, all these police cars. And I said, I'm looking puzzled, what are they here for? You know, I called a cab. And I said, what do you want? They said they wanted me. Me? What have I done? I know I'm drunk. I've called a cab. Well, you won't need a cab. Why? Well, you're coming with us. I've never been arrested at this point. And so, hey, you know, I have my suit and tie. I'm looking all good, I think. And, of course, I'm drunk. So they put me in the car and handcuffed me, and we're driving into Hollywood. I said, surely there are bigger criminals in Los Angeles than me. I'm drunk. I know that. I didn't impress them. On we went. So we get there in the police station, and I don't know, we went through whatever we went through, but I remember I had to get naked at one point in time, and I never liked doing that anywhere. This is fairly embarrassing. I don't know what's happening here. And they put me back together, and I got my own little cell across from what I now know to be the drunk tank, because I could see all those people mingling there, and it's kind of a status thing. You know, I felt a little bit special over there. And I had seen Perry Mason, so I knew you could make phone calls, so I asked if I could call. So I get to the phone, and I make a collect call. I call the White House of the United States. I ask for the White House in Washington, D.C., please. And they ring on, and the operator on the other end says, we don't accept collect calls. And they hung up on me. But I'm persistent. I call back. I said, I want to speak to so-and-so in the White House. And they said, well, he's not here. He's out in San Clemente at the White House on the West Coast. And this guy was my fraternity brother. He was the press secretary for Nixon. Now, I started to think, you know, Nixon's in enough shit without me. He's got all these troubles, and here's this little drunk in Hollywood. And I don't even know what I was thinking Ron would do for me. You know, I hadn't seen, he was my big brother in fraternity, but I hadn't seen him for 10 years. But I'm calling him to get me out of jail. I want him to know how important I am. You know, it's just somebody I knew. The sad part of that story, about 5 years ago or less, I got a call from his wife, Ron's wife. And Ron became an alcoholic, as did a number of people in that administration, friends of mine who I went to school with. And he she wanted me to try to talk with him and carry on about things. I tried, but he didn't. He died, it was last year or year before, I don't remember which, the last 2 years anyway, up and died, just a hopeless, helpless, hapless alcoholic. So I have learned it don't matter whether you're up here or you're down here, it kills you the same way. Alcohol will kill anything living, preserve anything dead, so, you know, anyway, old Ron went the way. Anyway, when I was in jail, you know, my mom said, what's wrong with you, Pat? I don't have any idea, Mama. I don't really have an idea. She said, well, you know, I just hope you can do something. Mom, I promise you I'll never do it again. 2 months later, I'm in jail again. Yeah, arrested again, driving, and again. And I had been to my mom's house about 2 in the morning. Bars closed at 2, and I got to my mom's house. And I said, hey, I just want to play some music and have some more drinks. And I do that. And Mom said, what's wrong, Pat? Well, you know, if only my life were like my brother Happy. Happy is my youngest brother. Well, I said, you know, he's married. He's got 4 kids that love him. He's got 2 cars. Good job. Me, I don't have anybody. I've been thrown out. My car's wrecked. Here I am, you know. And so she'd pat me on the back, I guess. And then they told me the story a couple of weeks later. Happy's sitting in that same place doing those same things. He's drinking, playing the music. Mom's saying to Happy, what's wrong with you? Oh, if only I was like that rascal Pat. He doesn't have these 4 kids strapped around him. He doesn't have a wife that beats him up. Well, he doesn't have to go to work. You know, he doesn't do all these things. Each of us could see each other's life as just the opposite of what ours was, and we wanted that life. And that's kind of the way I always, and the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence until I get over there and pee on it, and then it's just as brown there as it was over here. That's one of the problems. Anyway, I had lots of silly drinking stories that took place for me, but a lot of accidents, car accidents, 2 divorces, a number of other separations. Moved a lot, had a company that was pretty supportive of me because I did a pretty good job for what I was doing at that time. But anyway, I'd gone to jail one more time. I was arrested in front of the Mormon church at midnight. And this time I just said, oh shit, I knew what was coming. I just put my hands on my back, I got out of the car, didn't say anything. But what was so pitifully demoralizing to me was that Mormon church there. You know, I married a girl. My first high school girlfriend was a Mormon and went to that church. And I could see that congregation say, that's what we're talking about. You know, they don't smoke or drink, and they look, this is what happens. And I'm the classic example of that. So I go, and I go to jail. And the next day when I get out, my mom and dad again, I get a call from my little brother. And he said, Pat, don't you think it's about time? It's about time what? About time you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, what the hell are you talking about, Hap? He said, well, we talked about it 6 months ago. Come on, come with me. And this was on a Wednesday night. Thursday night. He had just left the Navy. He called me at 10:30. AA means go from 8:30 to 10 out there. So he called me after he got his courage for a little brother to call a big brother and tell him anything is hard to do. And we don't let him tell us anything. But he did. So I said, okay, let's go. We went on Saturday night. He couldn't go Friday night because he had a pigeon race. I said, well, that's my first resentment. Damn pigeons are more important than your brother. You call one to save me, now I have to wait till Saturday. So I went to Saturday to a speaker meeting with Happy, and there's a guy named Sam, big smile. He came, he grabbed my hand, he said, hey, newcomer. He said, come on in. We've got a place for you. He said, I've got a chair right here for you. It's your chair. And honestly, I sat there in that chair for the next 2 years thinking it was my chair. I'd never been to a meeting, but he said, this is your chair right here. Sit down. We have a place for you. And that's about what I remember that night. There was a guy up there that tells silly stories like I'm telling you right at the moment, but it was cool to me that I felt like I was received. I felt like so many other places had been throwing me out. My favorite bars didn't want me there anymore. My friends didn't want me to come over there anymore. My wife had already thrown me out. I'm living in a little one-room place by myself. My car is totaled out. I had it totaled out, didn't get it for 2 months, got on Friday, totaled it again on Sunday. I had a day and a half. That's the way I drank them. Anyway, I went to a men's stag then on Monday night, and there was a guy there that came from Palmdale, which is about 50 miles away from where this particular meeting was, and I said, I know why he came here. He doesn't want anybody in his neighborhood to see him coming to meetings, so he's driven all the way down here. And he got up there and he said, you know, I like to come to this meeting. He said, there's good sobriety here. There's a lot of people with 10, 20, and 30 years come to this meeting. That's why I come down here, is what he said. He said, and I'd like to say, newcomers, if you're here and you have any problems with alcohol, you're in the right place. He said, you don't ever have to hurt again if you don't want to. He said, you paid all the dues you have to pay, unless you want to pay more. But you don't, you're all paid up by the time you get here in that department. And he said, if you'll give this program half as much time as you've given to drinking, you will be a winner. And I said, my God, that would be a lot of time to give to this program. Where would I get that time? Well, I'm here to say it so. You know, this goes till 9 o'clock?
Yeah.
Well, I see you looking at your watch. Are you hurrying?
Just timing, you know.
All right. Thought maybe that was a sign. Wrap it up, get the hook, and get me out of here. That's the way Clancy would take it. He'd stop. He'd sit down. Anyway, I went to another meeting, and there was my insurance agent. My God, she says, rates will go down for everybody. I always had this little alcoholic dog that was running in front of my car constantly. You know, I'd swerve to hit the dog, and I'd run into the fence or the tree or the parked car or the whatever it was. She said, you know, Pat Walt, which was her husband, always said he prayed for you every night that you would come to AA. And Walt worked for me. He was in AA 25 years, and he never once mentioned it to me. And wise that he didn't, because I would have fired his little ass. Even think that I had such a problem. And Walt died of a heart attack in our parking lot one night. And I had said of him often, he is the kindest, gentlest man I know. He is one of the sweetest people I've ever known on this planet. And she said, well, you see, Pat, Walt's prayers have been answered. You're here. And that touched me a lot. It moved me a whole bunch just to know that somebody was thinking about me, you know, along the troubled times. One of my high school friends, I called him. I hadn't seen him for 20 years, and we got reconnected. We were like brothers as kids. He said, you know, I was there for the good times. I wish I'd been there for the tough times. Those are the kind of people I like to be around me. You know, the ones I put in a rowboat with me, and when we need the rowboat out in the middle of the boat, I know who's going to not eat me, who's going to try to help me. Anyway, I get in there, and I start hearing all these things about steps and sponsors and books And sponsorship, I think, is one of the keys, is the key to success in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think if there's a weak spot in this whole deal today, it's in sponsorship, is my opinion. I don't think that we people have it nearly as good as I had it. I had a sponsor. I picked my first sponsor was a woman. She was 65 years old and 18 years in AA. And the reason I picked her, because I was told to pick a sponsor that would be something like I would like to be like. Not that she would know what's in the book, but I wanted to live a life like this person lived. This person had an interesting and fascinating life. Wonderful talker, very active, started all kinds of AA programs, various things for the post office system and others, traveled around the world, said, I want to be like Betty. And so I asked Betty to be my, I have a man sponsor also, but Betty was my starting sponsor. She had this big sign in her office up here that says, life's in session, are you present? You know? And we did wonderful things. We didn't go to AA meetings. She'd call up San Francisco and say, I've got 9 people. We'll be there on Friday. We want meetings Friday night, Saturday morning, Saturday noon, Saturday night. We'll leave you Monday. Have food and places for us. Bye. Boom. Just like that. That's how she sponsored people. We rent a big station wagon, all go, we tell stories, we go up there and have just a wonderful weekend looking around San Francisco. She'd say, we're going to a high school football game Friday night. Life's in session, there's things going on while I'm sitting here scheming. You know, I got to get out there and get to be a part of, is what she was teaching us. One night we had to sit in a circle, and a person, one chair was in the middle, and each of us had to take a turn being in that chair. And then the room would go around and they had to say one thing they liked about you. And it's very easy to give the gift. It's hard to receive it when you don't feel worthy and valuable. But it's a wonderful thing to do. If you haven't done it, try it sometime. Everybody can find one something. If it's the way you comb your hair and brush your teeth or whatever it might be. But it's a great gift to give, especially this time of year. And I was sober, came in this time of year, and I said, geez, how will I get through New Year's Eve? They said, Pat, this is August. You know, well, I got to... Well, today I know that's amateur night. We don't even think about that anymore. New Year's, I never go out. I'm fearful I'd be run over by one who doesn't know how to drive like this. Anyway, I had all these terrific people, the sponsorship, and my sponsors I've always called Hallmark. It's when you care enough to get the very best. And I wanted the very best. I hung around them. I followed them everywhere. I followed all the great, the known AA people with wonderful principles just to learn how to... I wouldn't go to a fellow begging on the streets to ask him how to be a millionaire. I'd go ask a millionaire, how do you be a millionaire? I ask people, how do you do what you do? And then I try to do what they do if I want to be like that. That's what's happened for me. Well, our program says something to the effect that the main objective of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. I'm looking for a big book. But that's what it says. The main object of the book is to enable me to find a power greater than myself that'll solve my problems. If self gets self into trouble, it takes power greater than self to get self out of trouble. And God then is the main ingredient of this. We call it HP. My sponsor said HP was sitting on her shoulder, or higher power. HP meant Hollywood Park, Highway Patrol, half pints. It meant a lot of HPs, but it wasn't a higher power. And I read a book at that time by Jess Lair called I Ain't Much, But I'm All I've Got. And in here he had met an alcoholic. He's the guy who eventually starts Emotions Anonymous. And he starts this thing about God, how the alcoholic taught him he had to make a 15-inch trip. I have to move my head to my heart to find God, where he was the last place that any person would look for him, an alcoholic. We have to look within ourselves to find it. It isn't out there. It's in here. There's an outside world and an inside world. It's inside this world of Pat is where I find these things. So he says it's kind of like if you're lost in the forest and you start, look up, you see the North Star, and you start following that North Star. Somehow you get out of the woods, but you don't ever get to the North Star. Well, that's the way this God thing is, this higher power thing. I start following something that I don't quite understand what it is, but it is, and so I follow that, and somehow I get out of the woods, but I don't ever get to it, so to speak, at least that I'm aware of. So by changing my mindset to following something, my path, I had always said I would be dead by 30 years of age, and I did my very best to try to do that. I thought I'd done everything, been everywhere. I'd done nothing and been anywhere. But in my mind, I had. I didn't care if I went another day. I advertised it many times over. I'd be dead by 30. And I'm sure glad I didn't. Anyway, that's a senior moment now. I forgot what I was talking about. No, it's damn early. Anyway, well, I'll just talk about something else. I'm talking about God, I know that, but, and Jess Lair. Well, there was another guy at that time who wrote a song called Why Me, Lord? Chris Christopherson, he had joined up with us at that time. And his song starts off, Why Me, Lord? Maybe I could show someone else what I've been through myself on my way back to you. And that's kind of helped put a little, when I said I was happy to be an alcoholic and I'm grateful, that's why I'm happy and why I'm grateful. I have a purpose. I know what I'm to do today. I don't have to guess what am I going to do. I know what I'm going to do today, each day of my life. I have a reason for being. I have a friend who owned an apple orchard in California. Oh, Pat, you've got to come up and see my apple orchard. I said, why? He said, oh, well, in the wintertime, all these old dead trees, it looks like nothing. Spring comes, the little leaves get, and then there's some blossoms, and it fills out with apples. It's the most wonderful thing to see. I said, Jack, I've got one, but I got one better. I get to do the same thing with people. I see people who don't have a spark in their eyeball. Get that little spark, turns into a big smile, and their lives become huge and full again. I said, that fills me in a fashion which I can't tell you. You know, it does everything for me. So that's the beauty here. My sponsors would always give me things to. Paul would call and say, Pat, what are you doing Friday? I said, oh, I was going to go to the movies with Sue. He said, was going to is correct. What you will be doing is you'll be making a talk Friday night. They always gave me lots of directions. I spent a lot of time in Skid Row activities on Clancy's joint. I did federal penitentiary program for 5 years. I said, why would I do the penitentiary, Paul? I haven't been there. He said, yeah, but if you go as a guest, you never have to go as a resident. Well, that makes sense. So then it was hard for me to give it up. I had to give it up. He said, you've got to let it go, Pat. Let somebody else have some fun. It's time for you to move on to other things. So I did. Anyway, those are the kind of encouragements and the nudges I get. I think to stay excited and interested in anything, you have to have passion. And to have passion, I think I have to constantly reinvent what's going on in my life. I couldn't just come and sit in a meeting and go home every day. Sit in a meeting and go home. I've got to be into action somehow. I'm a human doing, not a human being. I've got to do. And along the way, I find new avenues of doing that, like this trip to England, for example. I'm trying to get a program started like we do in golf, try to get five of them to come here and stay with us for a week. We entertain them, taking the meetings all over the place, and then the next time, five of us go over and stay with them. Things like that, for example. Many of you know I work down at the Extension. I hang out with that crowd down there, spend a lot of time in trying to make that grow, and we're trying to get our women's program established there to start doing things. But this is what energizes me, never being satisfied with just everything is the way it is, always trying to see if there's some way we can fill a need. Can we make something better? Can we help AA grow? But at the same time, maintaining the principles that we've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. The steps, of course, are the cornerstone to our success. I don't think there's any way to be successful without spending some time right here and getting this done and doing it quickly. We don't ever do anything when we want to or when we're ready. But often we just don't get ready. But we just need to press on and get it done. If you go back to the beginnings of things, people were doing these things in their first day in, their second day in, third day. They didn't wait for years to, gee, I think I'll do it. You know, get on with being good to yourself. One of the things we have to learn is how to be good to ourselves. I think here we're learning how to be our own best friend. And if you aren't your own best friend, remember you better be, because you're nobody else's. Because they will be their own best friend. And that's what we have to learn to do. I don't mean to be selfish, self-centered. I mean to take care of me, to quit doing the things that are tearing my life apart and the things that will build my life and help me be a better human being. That's what I need to do. And how do I do that? By listening to those who've done it before. I'm always grateful to people who've been down this road before me because they make the path far wider. If I had to blaze the trail, we'd probably, well, we'd be sinking a battleship somewhere. But I'm glad there's others that have been down the road and said, no, you don't want to do that. Here's another way to approach this whole deal. When I got here, I got some physical checkups. My blood pressure was horrendous before I got. I found out I had high booze pressure, not high blood pressure. I was here about 60 days, and I was hearing Chuck Chamberlain speak one night, and he said, he said, well, my book don't say I'm going to turn my will, my life over the care of God and Valium. I said, how do you know? I was on Valium. I didn't realize that was a part of the program. So I disclosed this to my sponsor, and we go home, and I said, I made a decision. I'm going to stay sober. I'm going to die sober. I don't give a damn what happens to me. I'm going to die sober. So I took all my little vials, pink, all these different colors, and poured them into the toilet. And honestly, those were my best friends. I wanted to dive in there with it. And I flushed it, and I cried. And then I had horrible headaches, and I sat uncomfortably here for at least a year and a half. I'd taken them for a dozen years. I wasn't into a lot of the other stuff, but Valium I did just to stop me from shaking so badly every morning. But I learned to let go of those kinds of things and try to build this life. There's one little story. It's getting closer to quitting time, but one little story I'd like to tell. It's about this fellow who was up here in Tennessee, and he didn't know who his father was. He was an illegitimate child. He used to say he always walked around looking at the tops of his shoes. You know, he couldn't really look people in the eye. He was always embarrassed. And so he was at a church with a new pastor, and the new pastor, after he finished the sermon, the little boy said he tried to get out the back door. He was 14 years old when this happened. He said the new pastor was faster. He got to the back door, and they want to shake your hand, know who you are. He said, little boy, he said, whose son are you? Oh, he said, never mind. I can see you're a child of God. Go and claim your heritage. He said that one sentence changed his entire life. He then knew who he was. And with that, he then became governor of the state of Tennessee twice, actually, as an illegitimate child. He knew who he was. He was a child of God's. So that's my point about giving strokes, not pokes. It's the little things that make huge differences. Our little smart-ass comments don't do the world a good. What does some good is to try and find something good about that human being and plant that in their head. Give them a good positive thought to go. Mind can't hold a positive and a negative thought at the same time. So give it some good positive thoughts. Energize it. I read an article I sent to some of you on happiness the other day. And it concludes that if at the end of every one of your days, and then they've done research on this one, and most of them is just books people write and ideas they have, but this one's research. Every night before you go to sleep, think about three good things that happened in your day. Just three good things. And do that night after, and it changes. I mean, you'll instantly change how you feel. I've already gotten evil. Yeah, I read the article and I felt better. But you do. I mean, and so it's just what is, you know, we're training our mind. These people say, aren't you brainwashing yourself? Yes, I already have. I've done a very adequate job of brainwashing myself into thinking I'm not worthy of much of anything. So what I'm doing here is trying to improve my lot. Let's see. I wrote a note or two here just, oh. I have to tell a couple of little things. I wrote a note because I couldn't remember if I would remember anything at 8 o'clock in the morning. I had horrible sinus problems when I came. It said we had to be willing to go to any lengths, and truly I do believe coming here at this hour is 3 or 4 hours ahead of any lengths. But anyway, I had the horrible sinus problems. They said to put these ginger roots up in your nose and sleep, and it would cure sinus problems. They said if you can't get ginger, then get carrots. So I got carrots and made these little slices, and I lay back, and I put the bed in my nose, and I'd sneeze, and the carrots would fly out, and I'd reinsert them. Well, you know, the lady who lived downstairs must have heard my sneezing. We're still married 30 years later. It cured my sinuses and got a wife at the same time. But these are silly little things, but it was given to me by my sponsor. My point is, be willing to try things. My sponsor, you say, did you hear that noise? I say, what noise? Your mind slamming shut. You know, it's keep an open mind. Relationships, the words that all sponsors hate to hear. I don't ever want to hear that. I'm out of town for 2-3 months. Anyway, well, we all have them. Anyway, my sponsor, I was bemoaning the fact that I didn't have a wife or a girlfriend, and I said, you know, we've been, she said, we don't have any relationship for first year, Pat. I said, but how about the 6 months before I got here? He said, well, you don't get credit for that. So what I got, what they gave me was a pillowcase with a lady's face on it. Said, sleep with this. And I did. I've had wonderful people in my life. Anyway, I thank you very much for letting me come out here today. There's a million stories. I used to say, as Damon knows, I only have two talks, 1 hour and all night, and I never know which one I've started. But I could talk all night about all the wonderful things that have taken place. AA has given me this life beyond my wildest dreams. I've been around the world maybe 30 or 40 times. I've been to AA in many, many countries of the world. I find AA the same everywhere I go. Wonderful people. Anytime you go somewhere, make an AA contact there first. They'll entertain you. They'll show you their homes, how they live, take you anywhere, do anything in the world for you. And Australia was my favorite because they serve tea. I'm a tea, hot tea drinker. I don't drink coffee. I said, finally, a civilized AA meeting. Let the Yank talk. Let the Yank talk. That's the way they talk to you. That's the way they talk. It's just a wonderful society. You know, we learn to laugh again. That's what I loved most about AA. I learned to laugh again. Down in here, some, not one of these little phony, a real, genuine laugh. And I always close with the little, first I say, well, no, I'm quite close. I like to say, if you don't know God, you have missed everything, truly. If you don't know me, you haven't missed anything. But missing God is missing everything, in my view, in this program. And there's this, my favorite little story that lots of guys used to tell along the way, and I always tell it, and I haven't heard it today, so I want to hear it now, is this story of the auctioneer. And they start the auction out on the stage. A man opens up this dusty old violin case, pulls it out, and the violin's dusty, the strings are dangling, and he plays a noise, and it screeches, and it's horrible. And they start the bidding. What's the bidding? $1, $2, $3, $4, and the bidding ends. Whereupon an elderly gentleman gets up, he goes up there, he blows off the dust, he fixes the strings, tightens up the bow, and he begins to play again the most beautiful music they've ever heard. And the bidding starts again, 50,000, 100,000, half million. And what's the difference between those two scenarios is the touch of the master's hand. Well, that's much the way it is when we come here to AA. When I show up, I sell you parts of my body for $1, $2, $3, $4, my blood, my whatever. And that's the bid that starts. But after having been here for a little while and working this program, hanging around people like you, the bidding starts again. And it becomes a priceless event. And you ask me, what's the difference between those two events? It's the touch of the master's hand. Thank you.
All right, sweeties. I'll be gently.
I didn't get a drink of water, did you?
Thank you, Pat. Especially another hand just for getting up that early.
Yeah.